Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this April 13, 2023 panel of oral arguments this morning. We have three cases on our calendar this morning. First one is State of Minnesota versus Robinson. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions. They're indicated in the podium. And I'll just mention that you'll see that there are three microphones in front of you. And that just gives you the option. You can choose to use the middle podium, which is set quite high. There's a button on the front that allows you to lower it or raise it to match your height at your convenience. You have the option of using either of the two closer podiums if you'd like. If you're concerned for health reasons, if you have any concerns whatsoever, you're free to choose. There's just no light and clock on those particular podium, so you'll have to look over at the middle. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of the proceedings in our oral only recording, and we make those recordings public. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Frederick Getz and I represent the appellant Connie Marie Robinson. Since Crawford was decided in 2004 by the United States Supreme Court, it's become a principle, a foundational, fundamental principle of our Confrontation Clause jurisprudence that an accused has a right to confrontation, that it is violated when testimonial evidence is admitted at a trial and that accused has had no prior opportunity to cross-examine the declarant. Information provided by an informant to a law enforcement officer that an accused has engaged in criminal activity is testimonial evidence. Such testimonial evidence from an informant to a police officer was introduced against Connie Robinson at her trial for first-degree sale of controlled substances as proof that she was guilty of that offense. Connie Robinson never had any opportunity to cross-examine that witness.
As proof that she was guilty or as proof that police suspected her and had a reason to stop her? I thought that was the state's justification offered to include that evidence.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that was a guise. It was a bait and switch, though that was their explanation, and they tried to shoehorn it in under that exception. It's clear from the way the evidence was used at the trial, especially in the closing argument, that this was introduced as evidence of guilt. Absolutely. It was introduced for its truth.
As it regards prejudice, which element do you believe that the evidence, this testimonial evidence, was significant in light of the other evidence of guilt?
In terms of elements of the offense?
Right. I mean, you've got possession. Did she possess the drugs? Well, there were 9 pounds of cocaine found under the car that she was associated with in a down and back from Texas. Was she possessing the drugs with the intent to sell them? You've got the money counters in her apartment and the gun near the money counter in the apartment. In light of that testimony, what element do you think was most significantly affected by what you say is the testimonial evidence?
Certainly, Judge Ross, it would be the possession element. Because in this case, there was no actual sale that the state had to prove that she was in possession of the controlled substances. And this was a constructive possession case. I think that's undisputed. This was not actual possession. She didn't have it in person. So the whole issue at trial was, did Connie Robinson constructively possess those drugs, the 4 kilos that were underneath, hidden underneath the vehicle. And that brings in questions, of course, of dominion and control. So to get to your question, what the evidence did, the testimonial evidence, it really metaphorically put Connie Robinson in the driver's seat of this whole operation. Because this information that Connie Robinson went from Minnesota to Texas to purchase drugs and then bring them back to Minnesota put her in an operational mode in this whole thing rather than just being the passenger as she was. So it inferred to her a degree of knowledge, a degree of planning that only came from that evidence.
Well, I mean, you say that's the only place that knowledge came in. When she was stopped in Bloomington, Minnesota after having a 20-hour down and a 20-hour back trip to and from Texas, and she was asked what she was doing, it was driving around. I think that was the answer that she gave.
That's true.
Doesn't that indicate some knowledge of culpability, knowledge that the drugs were?
I don't think it indicates knowledge. It's certainly not anything that's exculpatory, and one could make inferences, but it's not certainly as direct and as powerful as this direct evidence from an informant that she was in an operational mode here. And Judge Ross, it's very important, I think, to contemplate the harmless error standard that's applying here. It's the surely unattributable standard. So the court, the state has to show and the court has to find that this evidence, which is much more powerful, even if I accept your premise that, you know, her evasive statements could suggest guilt, they're absolutely not as powerful as information from an informant that she was going down to Texas to bring drugs and bring them back to Minnesota. On top of that, you also had the other information from an informant that when she got back to Minnesota, she distributed drugs out of hotel rooms. So that explained away, and that was the only evidence the state had to explain away, that the significant absence of evidence of any drug dealing by Connie Robinson at her home. They had her under surveillance. Was there any frequent activity to and from the home? No. Was there any evidence of drug dealing and trash searches? No. You mentioned the money counters. There were two of them, but there was no connection of those with drugs. They never did any ion scan or any kind of forensic analysis of those devices that actually showed they were used to count drug money.
What about the fact that there were guns found in the home? And case law does acknowledge that there's often a nexus between guns and drugs.
Judge Reyes, that's a good question, and that's a separate argument in terms of the errors of the trial court. But if we're looking at that as evidence of guilt under the harmless error analysis, which I think your question goes to, those cases that have allowed a firearm to come in as a tool of the drug trade all have a closer geographic proximity between the firearm and the drugs. I've cited those cases in my brief. For example, if a gun is in the bedroom in this case and the drugs were found in the basement, well, there's enough of geographic proximity for it to come in. And I think there was testimony by one of the officers in this case, though, that we often find drug dealers might have drugs on them to control the drugs or protect the drugs. There was no firearm on Connie Robinson in Bloomington.
The argument is, I think, persuasive, except for the presence of the money counters. And I understand the defense argument at closing was, well, she was involved in real estate management, so she might have been collecting rent money, and you might need money counters to count cash. But if that's not the case, if a jury were to disbelieve that well, of course you don't need money counters, the jury might surmise, to count rent, it's got to be a large quantity. And isn't there a nexus then? Assuming that the drugs that were being sold and the cash counters were being used, the machines were being used for that transaction, wouldn't that be enough of a nexus between the gun and the counters to include that as evidence of culpability?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, again, I think there was nothing affirmative with those money counters other than the inference, the speculation that they had something to do with drugs. There was no affirmative evidence showing that those money counters had ever been used to count money, drug money. There was also no large amounts of cash found in that home itself. So I think just having these devices does not create enough of a nexus then to allow the state to bring in evidence of the firearm.
But doesn't that, I mean, again, the state's theory is that she's not doing this in her home. She's doing it somewhere else. So then she would take, presumably, the cash counters to some other location. Or count cash, sell the drugs, and then count cash in the home. Is that not? I'm trying to see how it's inconsistent with the state's theory.
Respectfully, I think it is a presumption upon a presumption upon a presumption. It just goes too far. We have to look at the cases where the firearms have come in, and those cases have by no means been as far in terms of a geographic disconnection than exists in this case. And I'm not aware of any authority, Your Honor, that would allow evidence of a gun to come in at a remote location just because there'd be one other possible indicia of drug dealing found there when there was no actual drugs found at that house. So respectfully, I don't believe there's any case law that would draw that connection that you're putting forth, Judge Roth.
Besides a financial occupation, can you think of any other reasonable basis for an individual to have multiple cash machines in their home?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe this came out at trial, but Ms. Robinson, she had other business ventures beside the real estate that did not involve drug dealing, music producing shows and stuff like that. So there's a lot of cash-based businesses out there.
I didn't see any discussion of that in the closing argument.
There wasn't. But I guess the question, can you think of any other reason? And I can. There's a lot of cash-based businesses out there, and it's the state's burden. You know, the state has the burden of proof here to show that they did have some connection. It's not Ms. Robinson's burden necessarily to show that they were not connected.
As to your alternative defendant theory, alternative perpetrator theory, I mean, did the state argue that this was only your client's drugs, or this was a joint operation between the gentleman in the car and her?
The state basically put forth both theories, that it didn't have to, they didn't have to show that she exclusively possessed it. It could be joint possession. But dissimilarly, the defense was that we wanted to show that it was just Davian Greenwood who was the person who controlled this whole operation. And on that note, and this gets to the third issue, the trial court abused its discretion, and you know, it's de novo review for the Confrontation Clause analysis, abuse of discretion for the other evidentiary issues. But there we had evidence that Davion Greenwood had been involved in distribution of drugs, first-degree sale-level distribution of drugs, the same drug, cocaine, the same geographic area, Hennepin County.
But it was a 9-year-old conviction, right? I mean, doesn't that cut against its admissibility?
I think the date from the date of offense was about 8 years, Judge.
Well, and
Bjorkman,
assuming that abuse of discretion occurred, I mean, that wasn't the only evidence that was presented that you were able to present and discuss linking Mr. Greenwood to the cocaine.
You're right. You're absolutely right. He's the one who had the large amounts of cash in his possession. That's absolutely true. But it would have been, I think, a powerful piece of evidence that would have shown that he was, to get back to my earlier metaphor, he was the one that was not only literally in the driver's seat, but also in an operational capacity. Because he had the one that had the prior conviction and knowledge about how do you distribute drugs, because he'd been convicted of it before, first degree sale. And 9 years is that type of distance away. But I submit that respectfully, if these roles had been reversed and it was Ms. Robinson that had an 8-year-old drug conviction, the state would have been aggressively trying to get that piece of evidence in to show her opportunity, motive, plan, preparation, all of the 404B applicable exceptions. I don't think identity would have been an issue here. Well, I guess perhaps it arguably would have been.
This seems like an interesting issue because I can imagine if it happened the other way, if the state said, we would like to get evidence in about the gentleman's prior drug activity to show that the defendant was interested, knew that she was going down to Texas to buy drugs with someone who's a drug dealer. I could see the defendant saying, no, we want to keep that evidence out. It's sort of a fuzzy error, harmless error, prejudice issue in this case. It's the facts, I don't think, might cut both ways.
We deal with the case in front of us. And the case in front of us here was that I was seeking to get that evidence in. And it was evidence that I think if it had been the other way, the state would have sought to get it in. I would have different analysis. But I think, under the law, had that come in, at any rate, I think that was error to admit that evidence.
Counsel, I have a quick question on the standard review. You'd mentioned under Crawford, it's an abuse of discretion unless it's a Crawford issue, unless it's a Confrontation Clause issue. And you argue it's de novo, and the state has taken the opposite position. What case law specifically identifies that our standard of review of that issue is de novo?
State versus Sutter, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision from 2021.
Okay, and what language in Sutter specifically says that we review de novo?
If I may quote from Sutter, in general, evidentiary rulings are within the district court's discretion. However, we apply de novo review when determining whether the admission of evidence violates a defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause.
Okay, thank you.
And I see my time is about up. Thank you, Your Honors.
You will have 5 minutes to use for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
I'm a bit shorter, sorry.
You don't have to apologize for being shorter.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I'm going to try to discuss 3 points, and then we'll be more than happy to address any additional questions that this panel has. First, I'm going to the standard review, that Judge Reyes just asked about on that confrontation hearsay claim. There is a conflict in Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. I completely agree with what Mr. Goetz just said in terms of that quote. It's page number 764 from Sutter. He read it exactly, that they apply a de novo review to a confrontation claim. However, in Yang, which I cite on pages 6 and 7 of my brief, quoting here, we review a trial court's evidentiary rulings that result in an alleged violation of a defendant's right to confront witnesses for an abuse of discretion. Of course, Yang was a 2009 Minnesota Supreme Court case, so it postdated Crawford. So we have basically competing standards of review on evidentiary rulings grounded in a confrontation.
Is it really conflicting, though? Because it seems that Sutter is more, it clarifies that generally, yes, it is an abuse of discretion unless it involves the confrontation clause. And I'm not sure if Yang really gets into that much detail of differentiating when a confrontation clause issue is involved.
I hear what you're saying, Judge Reyes. I would refer you to Fleming, which is a decision of this court, non-precedential. Judge Ross authored it himself in 2016. The issue in that case was the defendant argued, quote, the arresting officer's testimony was inadmissible hearsay that violated his confrontation right, and this court applied a abuse of discretion standard review to the claim in that case. Again, 2016, non-precedential, predated Sutter, but it's very similar. In fact, it was cited in appellant's brief, not my brief, because appellant thought it was so close to the issue before this court.
Plus, that was Judge Ross, and who can rely on anything that...
To the extent a district court misapplies the law, I mean, we view that as abuse of discretion, don't we? So does it matter how we look at it?
I agree with that. There was no misapplication of the law in this case. I think talking about Sutter a little bit
Let's talk about that. It certainly feels like a non-compelling filter for a confidential informant to say she's taking drugs, she's driving down to Texas to get drugs. She's driving back to Minnesota to sell drugs from a hotel. And then an officer says, we are aware, or the prosecutor in closing says, the officer was aware of information that, essentially quoting the informant, it certainly feels like that's testimonial. It feels like the language of the court previously, backdooring a Crawford violation, trying to get the information in that otherwise would be excluded. Can you address that? I will tell you that the argument in your brief wasn't especially persuasive, so give it a run.
Thanks, Judge. I think we need to look at Sutter, and we need to look at Litzau in detail. And what I mean by Sutter is Sutter involved the admission of a body-worn camera video recording of a co-conspirator who was answering interrogation questions posed by a police sergeant. Here, in this case, we had testimony from Officer Werner, who is also the officer actually in Fleming, and then Sergeant Schroeder, referring to information that appellant was being investigated for narcotics and that was traveling to and from Texas for those narcotic-related purposes. I don't believe that defense ever objected to the additional piece of testimony which is tied together with that information, which is that Texas is a source state for narcotics and commonly visited because of its proximity to Mexico and how affordable narcotics are there as compared to elsewhere in the country. And so what I really want to
come from the CRI's testimony. I mean, I share Judge Ross's concern that you know, I think you would agree that if the officer testified, the CRI told me that the defendant was selling drugs out of a hotel or was driving to buy drugs, you'd agree that's testimonial. I don't understand the functional difference between the way the testimony came in here and a more direct testimonial reference.
A co-conspirator's statement in Sutter that was video recorded and answers to police questions, they concerned events that happened in the past as opposed to the suspicion or prediction of what could happen in the future, what the suspicion was that would happen in the future. And unlike in Sutter, in this case, there was no evidence or any indication that the information that Officer Werner referenced in his testimony and that Sergeant Schrader referenced in his testimony was the result of some sort of police interrogation. So if we really drill down into how precedent has defined the term testimonial, there is nothing about past events that was in the information that was addressed here.
Sorry to interrupt, but it seems though that the district court did seem to acknowledge, based on the discussion on this issue and its ultimate ruling, that the officer can testify about what the officer knew and information it obtained from its search, including that she was planning on going down to Texas. You mentioned it was unchallenged that drugs are cheaper down there. So there's that information that the officer could rely on. But it seems that the district court made a clear line of demarcation by saying, you can talk about her going down to Texas, but you can't talk to her about the information you received from the confidential, reliable informant, including that she's going down there to get drugs and going to come back up to transport the drugs back to Minnesota. And that's where it seems that the prosecutor crossed the line throughout the trial in terms of relying on that evidence. Isn't that, whether you call it error or abuse of discretion, isn't that in violation of Crawford by allowing in testimony from the that you can't confront from the confidential, reliable informant?
It is not. The primary purpose of that information that Officer Werner and Sergeant Schroeder reference really appears to be helping lead to the discovery of illegal narcotics.
But it's based on the confidential, reliable informant's testimony, information, statements that the CRI made to the police officer, not that the police officer obtained from his own research. That information, he did not get on his own. He got that from the CRI, right?
I see I'm making little headway with Sutter. Let's turn to Litzau, which did predate Crawford by 2 years, but has been reapplied many times by this court, including in Fleming, since 2004. I think it's important to think about what this trial would have looked like without a reference to that information that we're discussing right now, and why that information was so helpful to explain the actions of law enforcement, which of course is what Litzau permits. Without a reference to this information, the jury would have simply been told that 10 to 12 police officers, you know, seized a vehicle in Bloomington in which appellant was riding without any reason, without any traffic violation, without any justification. So without the information that this information that came from the informant that was sanitized, you know, in terms of just being called information in Officer Werner's testimony, without that information in front of the jury, it would certainly seem to the jury that the police had blatantly violated the appellant's Fourth Amendment rights, which, of course, is a claim that's never been raised in this case. And I really want to direct your attention to footnote 3 in Litzau, and that addresses really this precise situation. There, the Minnesota Supreme Court wrote, quote, in criminal cases, an arresting or investigating officer should not be put in the false position of seeming just to have happened upon the scene. He should be allowed some explanation of his presence
right.
and conduct.
And the district court in this case said, based upon the representation of the prosecutor, and I'll just read to you from the district court's decision, the state intends to offer testimony from Officer Werner that Ms. Robinson was, number one, under investigation for narcotics. Number two, law enforcement believed she was headed to Texas. This limited scope is admissible. And then, I mean, instead of just limiting the testimony to she was under investigation for narcotics and she was headed to Texas, the witness testified as follows. The information I had as part of this investigation was that when Ms. Robinson would be in possession of narcotics, that she would have a hotel room where she would possibly distribute the narcotics until they were gone. And then later on, the information was that she was headed to Texas to purchase drugs. That seems to go, even if you accepted the district court's restriction as appropriate under Crawford, the actual testimony seemed to go far afield of that. Do you agree with the premise? And if not, why not? And if so, why wasn't this a Crawford violation? At least why wasn't this testimonial under Crawford?
I disagree with the premise that I think I understand. Referring to the hotel reference, that was in response to attacks on the investigation that was done specifically on appellant's home. And I believe that information was came out in redirect. I think that's what you're quoting from, Judge Ross, was pages 445 to 446 of the trial transcript.
I think it was 431.
Okay. I believe that the that information was in response to a defense that was developed on cross-examination of Officer Werner, and I believe that is how Judge Thomas, the district court, allowed it to come in.
Okay, that may be so, but how is it not testimonial? How is it not simply relaying what the confidential informant told the officer? The information I had as part of this investigation was that when Ms. Robinson would be in possession of narcotics, that she would have a hotel room where she would possibly distribute the narcotics until they were gone.
Apart from the testimonial, there's also the truth of the matter asserted. I mean, and this information was not being, that's a three-part test that was cited in Fleming. I mean, it was definitely clearly stated in Sutter that one of the elements for a Confrontation Clause violation has to be that the information, the testimony, has to be offered for the truth of the matter asserted.
It's not
offered for the truth of the matter asserted. It's being offered to explain why they did not do trash pulls and why they did not do other additional narcotics-related investigation techniques at that particular home.
Well,
is that the police did not suspect.
In closing argument, as I understand it, the argument went like this. The hotel information. Officers did not suspect that defendant was selling out of her home. They had information she was selling out of her hotel room. Doesn't that suggest truth of the matter?
I mean, it's a statement by an attorney, so it's not coming from a witness for that purpose.
You were saying, well, this was offered for some other purpose. Well, the officer of the court, the prosecutor, is saying essentially, no, this is the purpose. It's to show that, you know, we had information she was selling out of the hotel room. Do you agree that that's problematic?
I would agree that's problematic. I understand the point that you're making. And I want to address a lot of things given our discussion. I see I only have about 130 seconds left, so I do want to just quickly address harmless error on the confrontation hearsay claim. And that is, there is enough to meet both the surely unattributive standard for that primary claim as well as the substantially influenced standard for the other claims if this court is to find that Judge Thomas erred. And that's because we had appellant's close friend renting an SUV in the Twin Cities when the appellant was in close vicinity. We had forensic evidence establishing that. Cell phone tracking data and established that appellant was riding in this rented SUV from the Twin Cities to Texas and back again, 40 hours of pure driving in a three-day period of time. When she was stopped in that SUV, and Judge Ross, I think one of your questions before hit on this, I mean, there was $500,000 of cocaine strapped to the underside of the vehicle, and even though 10 to 12 law enforcement officers swarmed at the stop, appellant had really little question as to why she was stopped or what was going on at that time. And then, quite importantly, in appellant's jail calls, which were made before her post-Miranda interview, before she had been told that police had located the 4 kilos of cocaine strapped to the underside of the vehicle, that is when she made numerous statements that reflected a strong consciousness of guilt, specifically about something illicit that was stored in the SUV. And as you mentioned,
and what were those statements, that she was concerned that the car get retrieved? That those statements in and of themselves indicate consciousness of guilt?
I believe they do, because it was a vehicle that she did not rent. She had no, a friend of hers had rented it a couple days before. She had no connection. She had no items that were stored in the vehicle still. There would have been no reason for her to be so concerned about what was stored in that car unless it was something that was found on the underside.
Really? So if I had a friend that rented a car for me, and the car was impounded while I possessed it and drove it, don't you think it'd be reasonable that I would be concerned that the car wouldn't be retrieved and returned and that maybe incurring additional fees for my friend, even if it's not my money?
Would you be calling your friend? Judge Ross, I see my time has expired. Can I answer your question?
Certainly.
Judge Ross, would you be calling your friend after that situation happened and really demanding your friend do everything in your friend's power to go get that vehicle back? Because that would be the equivalent situation of what we had here.
Well,
because
I think I can answer that question. If it was me, he would be.
And Judge Reyes, you know Judge Ross perhaps a little differently than mine. The point I'm trying to drive at is that she was talking to that very friend in those jail calls. And the tone, and that's not the only piece, Judge Bjorkman, to just wrap up the answer to that question. There were other statements of consciousness of guilt, a preference for federal prosecution over state prosecution, just being one example.
I know your time is up, but I'm going to take the liberty to ask one other question. You seem to be pointing to a lot of evidence that there was enough evidence to convict her without this, but the harmless error standard, beyond a reasonable doubt, asks for more, doesn't it? I mean, that the state has to show more than just that there's a lot of other evidence that would establish guilt.
It does. There's five factors. It's examining the record as a whole, and then the five factors being the manner in which it was presented, how persuasive the evidence was, whether it was used and how it was used in closing argument, and whether it was effectively countered by the defense. And then the fifth element is that strength piece. So,
thank you. Your time has expired. We'll let you go over a little bit. And although we don't ordinarily do this, I'm going to afford Mr. Goetz an extra minute. So 6 minutes in your rebuttal so that the state doesn't get an imbalance here. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Judge.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to move quickly through my few points. Respectfully, Judge Ross, you didn't have the benefit of Sutter when you issued Fleming. That came out 5 years after. So the standard of review. I don't think there's any issue or should not be any issue that this was testimonial evidence. I've cited three cases from other districts that have confronted this issue, the same thing in which it's couched as information, and they've all held that it is testimonial. But testimonial essentially is there an out-of-court statement to a law enforcement officer that's to describe past events that is potentially relevant to a later prosecution? And you have all of that here. This is historical. It was about her MO, if you will, her modus operandi. She would go from Minnesota to Texas to purchase drugs and come back. That was a historical event. When she would get the hotel, or she would get the drugs back to Minnesota, she would use hotel rooms to distribute them. That was historical evidence. So it was all about establishing her modus operandi again. The prejudice is because it put her in that control. It put her in an operational facility well beyond being a mere passenger who was just on for the ride. Short ride, 40 hours, but just a ride nonetheless. So it was testimonial evidence. The state did not need to present that information just to provide this background information about why the investigation. They had it. We started investigation on Ms. Robinson for narcotics trafficking. We got a GPS warrant. That showed the pings going down to Texas and back. We know Texas is a source state for narcotics. That's why we stopped the vehicle when it got to Minnesota, and this is what we found. They didn't need to introduce that at all. Under the guise of explaining why the investigation focused on Ms. Robinson, they introduced that testimonial evidence. I'm paraphrasing Litzau, but that's the danger that the Minnesota Supreme Court has been cautioning against for over 20 years. And it happened again in this case. And it deprived Ms. Robinson of her right to a fair trial.
And just so I understand, your argument would differ substantially if she was the only one in the SUV, because the argument goes, as I understand it, to distinguish her as the operative element in the drug trafficking from her co-occupant of the car. Is that correct or not?
It's a good question. I don't know. My answer to that question would be I don't know, quite frankly, because I would have to look at that being an entirely different case. You know, what was her connection with the vehicle and everything else? And respectfully, I'd have to really take some time to
Fair
think
enough.
It through.
Well, can you address the harmless error issue? Let's assume that we agreed with your argument that this is testimonial information. It's provided for the truth of the matter asserted. And the district court shouldn't have allowed it. Why isn't this harmless error in light of the significant other evidence of her culpability?
Because of the harmless error standard, number one, it has to be clear that the verdict was surely unattributable. And then when you apply the factors, just the factors themselves, the manner in which it was presented. This was not one reference by one witness. This was repeated references by two witnesses. That's exactly what you had in Litzau. It was evidence that was emphasized in final argument, in closing argument. And even beyond that, it was emphasized in opening statement. The other factor, it was highly persuasive because it was the only evidence, as I've said repeatedly, forgive me, but of Ms. Robinson being in that operational mode. This is how she did things, creating her as being the one who put this whole thing together. That was the only evidence of that. So it was highly persuasive. And the other factor the state didn't mention, but the defense couldn't counter it because I never had an opportunity to cross-examine that declarant. I had no ability to counter the evidence about these historical events, especially with respect to the dealing out of hotel rooms, because that was evidence that was just sprung on us in the middle of trial. It had not been previously disclosed in any report, and that's in the record.
Counsel, can I ask you, we didn't talk about this too much, but I want to ask you about the reverse Spiegel evidence, and specifically on the district court's ruling to not admit the past drug activity of Mr. Greenwood, who is the driver. You would agree that that does fall under the abuse of discretion standard alone.
I do agree,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, and we give pretty broad discretion to the district court in terms of its evidentiary rulings, and you argue cumulative evidence. So why shouldn't we defer to the district court's decision to say, no, I'm not going to allow that evidence in?
Because in this case, respectfully, it was an abuse of discretion. When you look at the Spiegel analysis, as I've outlined, the time, the place, the nature, even if, you know, getting back to Judge Bjorkman's question, the year, it should have come in. It was relevant, it was probative, and it was admissible. And I think given that also it went to the defendant's right to present a defense, to keep it out denied her or her right to a fair trial. Even if individually that error would have been harmless on that piece, you have the cumulative error when you compound it with everything else. And if I may just quickly get back to your question, Judge Ross, the last piece, that all of the other evidence was not strong, was not strong. These jail calls, she was concerned about her personal property in that vehicle, her purse with her identification and her credit cards. That's what the evidence showed was left there. She already knew that law enforcement were going to search her home, search her drugs. That was a fait accompli. So by the time she made those phone calls, there was no reason for her to quick get the car out of there before the police search it. They had already told her that they were going to do it. So I think those jail calls do not nearly carry the weight the state represents. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your briefing and for your oral argument today. Very helpful. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Have a good afternoon.